Welcome everyone to the Lowy Institute. Thanks for being here. My name is Roland Raja and I'm the Director of the International Economy Program here at the Institute. Today it's my pleasure to be introducing Dr. David Gruen, Deputy Secretary Economic at the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet and Australia's G20 Sherpa, who will be speaking to us today on the global economic order and the role of the G20. This year, of course, marks the 10th anniversary of the global financial crisis and the elevation of the G20 to a leaders level summit and to become the world's premier forum for international economic cooperation and coordination. When the GFC struck, it was of course the G20 rather than the G7 that rose to the occasion to respond. And since that time, the G20 has continued to do important work, even if this has been a little bit more under the radar than previously. For example, it has spearheaded important reforms to improve global financial stability and to improve international tax cooperation. But today, much of what the G20 is and represents is now under intense challenge, not least due to the backlash against globalization in many countries, and in particular, the America First approach of the Trump administration in the United States. At last year's G20 summit in Berlin, many dubbed it as the G19 rather than the G20, with the group's most important member, the United States, looking isolated on issues like climate change and resisting protectionism. And of course, the recent G7 meeting looked a bit worse than that. Today, we are now a few weeks out from the next G20 summit to be held in Buenos Aires, when we will see how far things have come since then. Suffice it to say that multilateralism has gotten a lot harder in recent times, but has also become more essential than ever, particularly for a middle power like Australia. Dr. David Gruen is uniquely placed to provide us with a clear-eyed view of the G20's role in the global economic order and its prospects for the future. As G20 Sherpa, Dr. Gruen leads the government's day-to-day work on the G20, framing Australian policy positions and prosecuting these with other G20 members to forward them. Before joining PM&C in 2014, he was Executive Director of Macroeconomic Group at the Australian Treasury and earlier served as Head of Research at the RBA. He holds two PhDs, one in physiology from Cambridge University and one in economics from the ANU. Dr. Gruen is among our most preeminent public sector economists and our most experienced public policy minds. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Gruen to the lectern.
Thanks very much, Roland. And thanks for the opportunity to speak to you and thanks to everyone for coming. So exactly a month from today, this year's G20 summit will be wrapping up in Buenos Aires. My job as Australia's G20 Sherpa is to make sure the leaders' summit is as productive as possible for Prime Minister Morrison and Australia. While the summit is the culmination of Argentina's host year, this year also marks a broader milestone for the G20, 10 years since its elevation to a leaders' meeting. Why is this anniversary worth remarking on? Because in those 10 years, we've seen something quite impressive happen. All G20 leaders attend G20 summits almost without exception. Nations, some with conflicting interests, continue to send their leaders to gather to discuss issues of relevance to them and at times to set the direction for the global economy. We have seen goodwill between these countries from all over the world with different levels of development and cultural traditions. And we have seen critical global issues confronted and sometimes faced with joint resolve. When Argentina was selected as 2018 host at the 2016 Hangzhou summit, then newly elected President Macri had no way to anticipate the profound macroeconomic difficulties that Argentina now faces. The international consensus on key issues has also fractured. The Hangzhou summit agreed on, quote, a rules-based, transparent, non-discriminatory, open and inclusive multilateral trading system with the World Trade Organization playing the central role in today's global trade, unquote. G20 leaders committed at that same meeting, quote, to complete our respective domestic procedures in order to join the Paris Agreement, unquote. At the time, it would have been a brave prediction that 2 years later, these issues of trade and climate would become the two most contentious and contested issues facing the G20. Argentina's challenge, as well as delivering new initiatives, is to seek as much agreement as possible among G20 leaders on these contentious issues. From its role in the global financial crisis to the current tensions, the G20 is perhaps best thought of as an institution that comes into its own when it is most needed, more a rough weather friend than a fair weather one. Today, I want to explore aspects of the G20's past, celebrate its progress, and share my thinking about its prospects as we prepare for the Buenos Aires summit. I'll come back to trade at the end. I'm the first to acknowledge that the G20 cannot be a panacea for the world's problems. But over the past 10 years, the G20 has been an important forum for international cooperation. Indeed, in Toronto in 2010, leaders declared it to be the premier forum for global economic cooperation. This cooperation is mostly in the form of discussion, but also at times decision-making, made possible and credible by its diverse membership. Of course, the G20 includes all the G7, all five permanent members of the UN Security Council, and all five emerging economy BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Members collectively make up nearly 85% of global output, 84% of global investment, and 63% of the world's population. We've never really had a forum like it. Declaring it as the premier forum for global economic cooperation was a profound statement about the G20's role in a rapidly changing global landscape. The G20 has shown itself to be a strategic tool. When used effectively, it has delivered significant results. Let me summarise some of them. Through it, member countries coordinated discretionary fiscal stimulus that averaged over 2% of GDP in both 2009 and 2010, facilitated an increase in lending from multilateral development banks of $235 billion at a time when private sector sources of finance were diminished, driven reforms to the international tax system through the G20 OECD Base Erosion and Profit Shifting Project, and implementation of tax transparency standards, and played a critical role in the ratification of the Trade Facilitation Agreement, which the WTO estimates could contribute possibly more than 5% to global GDP by 2030 if the agreement were fully implemented. The G20's current agenda is just as important as its past achievements. It has committed to reduce the gap between male and female workforce participation by 25% by the year 2025, which would add more than 100 million women to the global labour force, presuming, of course, that it was closed by women's participation rising rather than the opposite. And it is working to reduce the cost of remittances to an average of 3% by 2030, which is consistent with the Sustainable Development Goals, which at a minimum would give an extra $25 billion per year by 2030 to the people who most need it. Now, you don't need a global leadership forum in a unipolar world. The British Empire offered no other vehicle for collective representation of the colonies beyond perhaps the Empire Games. When you have a single superpower, coordination of global policy becomes relatively simple. Addressing globally significant issues is in their own best interests. In 1950, shortly after the Second World War, the US accounted for 27% of global GDP. No matter where in the world economic activity occurred, it's likely that someone in the United States benefited. This gave the US a clear interest in developing and supporting an open global trading and investment system. But as other countries grew to challenge US preeminence, the incentive for the US to bear the burden of coordinating the global economy became less compelling. The G7, what is true of the US is also true more broadly of the G7. The G7 countries comprised around, perhaps a little less, than half of global GDP for the whole 20th century until the early 1990s. Since then, the G7 share has fallen quite sharply. This year, the G7 will comprise about 30% of the global economy, and by 2040, it's projected to fall below a quarter. By contrast, the G20 accounts for a bit more than four-fifths of the global economy and is expected to still account for around that share in 2040. So the case for a broader grouping beyond the traditional advanced countries rests on the rapidly rising economic importance of countries beyond the G7. In this world, we can no longer expect one state to set the terms for all others, nor to underwrite global institutions alone. Effective global governance, including through fora like the G20, is essential as rising powers seek opportunities to influence and contribute to the global order. While governments always have the right to set their policies with little, if any, reference to other states, there are some fundamental areas where the global economic commons needs protecting, and there's no body better placed to help than the G20. The G20's toolkit ranges from simple exchanges of information and best practice to agreeing common measurable targets to coordinated action. None of this is achieved without consensus, nor is it enforceable except for the incentive of peer review and public accountability. The ambition of the G20 will wax and wane with the interests of the membership in collectively addressing economic challenges. Sometimes it will be limited to discussions amongst leaders and officials. However, discussion is not nothing. Thomas Schelling, in his great book, The Strategy of Conflict, highlighted how conflict itself can arise from coordination failure. If countries understand one another's objectives and capabilities, there is less rationale for conflict. For this, of course, you need communication. Schelling's insight led directly to the emergency phone line connecting Cold War Washington and Moscow. The G20 gives us more than phone connections. There's a real camaraderie, understanding, and a spirit of compromise among Sherpas, born from long hours working on a wide range of sometimes contentious issues and seeking to achieve as much agreement as possible. Indeed, when Adam Triggs at the Brookings Institution surveyed G20 policymakers, they commonly reported that the G20's value lay in building working relationships and networks and in better understanding each other's perspectives. In particular, it ensured that policymakers knew who to call in the event of a crisis. These benefits rarely appeal to the popular press, hungry for instant gratification, but the long-run benefits shouldn't be ignored. Not to mention that with a rotating chairing arrangement, members bring a sense of goodwill in the expectation that others will afford them the same courtesy during their host year. So improving communication is one way to reduce coordination failures, as is the opportunity created for leaders to move beyond talk and commit to action. Without question, the high point of the G20's effectiveness so far was when they did just that during the global financial crisis. The G20 leaders' meeting exists as a direct result of the fear, desperation, and waste of the global financial crisis. At the point of the G20's conception as a leadership forum, credit markets were freezing, stock markets tumbling, and financial firms collapsing. Over the 12 months from April 2008 to April 2009, the IMF's forecast for 2009 global growth fell from a healthy 3.8%, which is roughly the IMF's current forecast for next year, to negative 1.3%. So that's over the year from April 2008 to April 2009, the forecast went from 3.8% for global GDP to minus 1.3%. In their first ever communique agreed in Washington in November 2008, G20 leaders concluded that only enhanced cooperation would restore global growth and achieve needed reforms. At the time, and perhaps more so since, there are many views about the GFC and how it should have been managed. Yet the economics is quite orthodox. Because we have a global economy, when one country uses fiscal expansion to stimulate spending in their economy, some of the benefit leaks across borders. China's stimulus of 3.1% of GDP in 2009 and 2.7% of GDP in 2010 boosted investment in China, but also supported commodity production in Australia. Global cooperation can help ensure every country does its bit and is therefore more effective at responding to and recovering from a global downturn than countries acting alone. For monetary policy, the effect of a stimulus on other countries can be the opposite. Lower interest rates raise investment and consumption, but they also boost exports and inhibit imports by lowering the exchange rate, which reduces growth in other countries. Elements of this happened during the Great Depression. Perceptions that the UK, the US and France were each trying to beggar thy neighbour through currency devaluations didn't cause the depression, but it certainly contributed to it. As the GFC was gathering in intensity, the key global leaders were acutely aware of that history and determined not to repeat it. when they elevated the G20 to a leaders' meeting. Many see avoiding a shift into 1930s protectionism and the Great Recession becoming a Great Depression as the crowning achievement of the G20. The subsequent agenda involved re-equipping the fire department, particularly with the creation of the Financial Stability Board to build more resilient financial institutions, address too big to fail, and build a framework for robust market-based finance. The G20 also shifted its attention to supporting fiscal consolidation to reduce ballooning debt across the key countries, encouraging the structural reforms necessary for growth, and interrogating current account deficits for signs of risk. More importantly, recent research strongly suggests the G20 was responsible for a significant part of these outcomes, and that it was a result of genuine coordination rather than coincidence. According to policymakers there at the time, interviewed by Adam Triggs, it was because of the G20 that 11 of the G20 economies, not the major ones, but many of the others, undertook more fiscal stimulus from 2008 to 2010 than they otherwise would have. Further, the G20 provided collective support to countries to refrain from competitive exchange rate devaluations and from introducing trade protection during the crisis, as well as diffusing tensions around monetary policy spillovers. Some countries did more to reduce their debt and deficits because of the G20. Some implemented new or more ambitious structural reforms because of the G20, and some altered their policies to reduce their contribution to global current account imbalances. I think it's fair to argue that the G20's most critical role is as a global fire department, on call and ready if needed. Of course, fire departments are of their most use when there's a fire, but they need to keep their equipment in functional order, or for the G20 to maintain relationships and the functioning of the organisation to be ready when the next fire lights up. Much of the criticism levelled at the G20 is that it lost its way as a leaders' forum after the global financial crisis. With the burning platform extinguished, did mission creep rise from the ashes? I suspect many of you here today would hold that view. And it's true that the initial impetus for cooperation passed, and thankfully so. I don't think it's fair to hold the G20 to that same standard of crisis cooperation that was forthcoming at the time of the GSC. I don't think it's fair to hold them to that standard now. Naturally and appropriately, the G20's focus has shifted from crisis response to dealing with longer-term structural issues, global governance reform, sustainable growth, and structural reform. Some G20 achievements, like tripling the IMF's lending capacity and providing a common framework for the world's development banks to increase private investment, struggled to find room in academic publications, let alone the popular press. The G20 has pushed for and achieved progress on a range of issues that have been advanced even further below the radar. You won't have seen them in the headlines, but they will make a material difference to the well-being of people around the world. I've already spoken briefly about the effort to reduce the cost of remittances to developing countries, and they are beginning to bear fruit. Since the G20 first committed to reduce remittance transfer costs in 2011, they've fallen from a shocking 9.3% in mid-2011 to still high 6.9% in the third quarter of 2018. For a Pacific seasonal worker in Australia, this represents an average saving of around $9 on a $200 transfer. And for scale, according to World Bank estimates, around 110 million US in remittances were transferred from Australia to the Pacific Island countries in 2017. So it's a significant amount of money, especially for people who have such limited means. Or to give an example from the finance track of the G20 is the work on digital taxation. The spillovers associated with tax policy in individual countries make this a topic ideally suited to the G20. The debate over taxation of digital platforms, particularly as it relates to the location of value capture, is increasingly important given the size of these multinational digital companies, Google, Facebook, etc. To give a third example, Germany added global health to the G20 agenda last year, focused on addressing market failures in research and development and improving coordination to prevent the further spread of antimicrobial resistance, or AMR. Increasing resistance to antibiotics and a lack of new drugs means greater risk of infections that cannot be treated, with a growing and potentially enormous cost to the global economy. Chancellor Merkel injected momentum on this issue in Hamburg, with leaders committing to tackle the spread of AMR in humans, animals, and the environment. But it's also true that we've fallen short on some goals. Perhaps the most notable is the commitment G20 countries made in Brisbane in 2014 to undertake sufficient structural reform to raise the G20's collective GDP by 2% by 2018 above the IMF's projected baseline in October 2013, otherwise known as the 2-in-5 commitment. So the commitment was to raise GDP by 2% by 2018 above what was expected to be the GDP of the global economy by then. So we've reached 2018 and it's clear we'll fall short. Indeed, because of the more sluggish than expected recovery from the global financial crisis, the IMF now forecasts that 2018 G20 GDP will be about 2% lower than the October 2013 forecast, rather than 2% higher. Just says something about macro forecasts, something I used to spend a lot of time doing. That's all right, Morris. We all have that problem. Nevertheless, the effort wasn't in vain. The IMF assesses that the reforms boosted 2018 G20 GDP by a bit over 1% above the level had there been no reform. Further, countries learnt from each other's experience in implementing structural reforms. Again, according to the interviews that Adam Triggs did with the policymakers there at the time, Russian officials reported that they developed domestic policies to boost female workforce participation because of the G20, and South African officials said they implemented reforms more rapidly and pushed for more ambitious reforms because of the G20. Ambassador Joe Hockey also reports that the United States is considering an Australian-style asset recycling initiative, which it learned about during the G20. Having said that, the 2-in-5 commitment provided a lesson for us in matching ambition to political will. We are faring much better with the other ambitious goal set during Australia's presidency, which is to reduce the gender gap in workforce participation by 25% by 2025. Modelling by the OECD at the time suggested that achieving this commitment would raise G20 GDP by around 1.5%, implying that the 2-in-5 commitment would have been met through this policy initiative alone had it been achieved in full. Australia itself is 80% of the way to meeting this target. Beyond that, the goal continues to frame policy commitments and contributes to new policy developments both here and around the world, including in Russia, Japan, and Saudi Arabia. So I'm an optimist about the future of the G20. Its achievements often do not get much airplay, but they are still meaningful. And the G20 has avoided much of the bureaucracy besetting other international fora. There is no standing secretariat. Coordination is provided by a troika made up of the past and future G20 presidencies, with the current presidency as chair. Much analytical support is provided by existing international organisations, such as the IMF, World Bank, OECD, WTO, etc. And most importantly, we have an appropriate membership. Argentina's focus this year on the future of work has brought this conversation to the fore. Amid the diverse membership, countries have reacted in different ways to this theme. Some have focused on worker dislocation and changes to income distribution from technological disruption. Others have focused on the benefit of technological change, particularly the higher national income that comes with technological change. Emerging countries are particularly interested in whether robots and artificial intelligence will make the traditional path to development more difficult, with less workers needed in the industrialization phase. There are a number of reasons why technological disruption fits the G20's mandate. Technology crosses borders whether governments like it or not. How we manage that process matters for global income growth and distribution. And it's also important for maintaining domestic support for globalization. Advanced countries want a return on investments they have made in developing new technology, while workers everywhere want more secure employment and incomes. New technologies can change a country's terms of trade. The gains to Australia in the mining boom came both from higher commodity prices, but also from lower prices on Chinese imports as they rapidly advanced towards the manufacturing technological frontier. Other countries without our comparative advantage were not so fortunate. Many of the economic trends that have occurred because of the rise of the, particularly the Asian giants, may have only just started and underlie some of today's geopolitical tensions. The G20 can promote some solutions, such as improving education and skills and updating international trade agreements for the rules needed for the new economy. But the main benefit from the G20 undoubtedly is as a forum to air views and share experiences. In the G20, Australia has a reputation as a straight talker with a keen interest in maintaining the effectiveness of the G20. We support efforts, and we've led some of them, that seek to focus the G20 on a tighter agenda, supporting improved international cooperation and resisting the natural tendency for things to turn into Christmas trees. We also favour spending more time on big issues and direction-setting discussions rather than bureaucratic statements of intent. So I remain an optimist. The G20 is but 10 years young, and we still have the opportunity to make of it what we want and need. More immediately, what are the prospects for the Buenos Aires summit? Argentina's focus on the future of work will resonate with leaders and remain salient regardless of other developments. The real challenge will be in delivering an agreed communique while tensions remain on trade, climate change, and the 2030 agenda for sustainable development. The outcome of the Charleville G7 meeting earlier this year was not a good omen. We no longer live in a world where all the major countries accept key multilateral agreements and institutions, the Paris Agreement, the Sustainable Development Goals, and the WTO. We have taken broad support for these institutions and mechanisms for granted, and a loss of that support is confronting. Australia's prosperity has been built on access to an open rules-based global economy. That is a proposition with broad bipartisan support in Australia, not something you could say about many countries at present. We have 27 years of uninterrupted growth to prove it. The G20 represents the pinnacle of that global rules-based system, cemented in the foundation of each country's enlightened self-interest, where countries achieve more for themselves by working together. We would be delighted to see countries returning to the WTO to resolve their disputes and forestall more unilateral trade actions. And like many others, we strongly support reforms to the WTO to make it more effective. Having said that, if there is a profound economic or strategic disagreement between two major countries, say, for example, on trade, the G20 as an institution does not have the authority to resolve that disagreement. The G20 provides a forum for Sherpas and subsequently leaders to discuss the details and context of the disagreement. Discussions can involve the two countries in question and also other members of the G20 in whatever combinations leaders choose. That is a worthwhile contribution, even if, at the end of the day, the G20 cannot resolve the disagreement. There is no G20 campfire to help leaders see their existing policy choices in a new light. But there is a table around which G20 leaders can explain how they see the world, and there are plenty of corridors in which leaders can have frank discussions. Even if there were no final communique, fora like APEC, East Asia Summit and G20 provide opportunities for leaders to meet outside of the bilateral state visits and to talk to each other away from the megaphone. Perhaps most in this room would agree that that is needed now more than at any time since the G20 was founded. Thank you.
Thank you, David, for that excellent talk. And as you say, the G20 is not a panacea for the world's problems. It can only reflect what's happening more broadly in the world and try and have countries come together to cooperate and deal with those issues. Nonetheless, there's a lot of important work happening under the radar, so it was great to hear about some of that. We will now open it up to questions and answers with the audience. Please raise your hand so I can see you. Wait for the microphone, state your name and affiliation, and of course, please stick to a question.
Hello, David. Tim Jordan from the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. So one other way of thinking about the G20's impact is in terms of emissions. It represents about 80% of global emissions. But it doesn't feel like climate change has ever really emerged as an issue that the G20's dealt with very effectively. It's made a couple of paragraphs over in communiques over the 10 years. Is it the wrong kind of problem? You gave nice examples of other collective action problems that the G20 is good at addressing, but is climate the wrong kind of problem? Do you have any thoughts about whether it could come on the agenda again if it sort of loses its political toxicity?
So I think one of the things the G20 struggles with is which processes to... many things, including climate, are being dealt with under a different, under the Paris Accord. And that's true also of other things like the WTO. And so a lot of processes are going on that definitely involve the G20, but the G20 isn't the primary forum for discussions about those things. So the way I think about it, and certainly the way that the discussion carries on around the table, is that the G20 is there to provide political impetus for other processes, but it doesn't have coercive powers. It has the capacity to set standards, make statements of support, but ultimately, with climate, if one of the biggest emitters in the world, in the G20, the US, has decided to walk away from it, the G20 it just isn't the institution for changing that decision. It's not in a position to do that. Our aim always is to try. We think the institution's important and we don't want any of these issues to destroy the institution. But having said that, there's no question if you have something like climate, the G20 can't resolve it. It just can't.
Thanks. Mark Mosley from the Global Infrastructure Hub, which of course is a G20 initiative itself and one undertaken during the Australian presidency.
Yes.
You mentioned that one of the themes of the Argentinian presidency this year was the future of work.
Yeah.
The other theme that they had was infrastructure, and a fair amount's been accomplished during the course of the year. But the question is, where do you see the infrastructure agenda going in terms of it continuing to be a G20 priority, or how do you think G20 will approach the issues of infrastructure going forward?
So it enables me to say something more general. I will get to infrastructure. But one of the things that Australia has pushed is the idea that once one country puts something on the agenda, it doesn't automatically stay on the agenda forever, because otherwise you just end up with adding things and never taking them away. So we have pushed for not necessarily formal sunset clauses, but giving new presidents the kind of imprimatur not to always continue with initiatives of the previous country. So we are worried about the proliferation of issues. Having said that, I know infrastructure is an issue that is of profound interest to the Japanese, and so the Japanese will take it forward next year for sure. It's going to be one of the issues that they are thinking through. They've, as you probably know, the next year is going to be rather truncated because the Japanese will have their summit in late June. But nevertheless, infrastructure. I think the Japanese thinking is that infrastructure is one of the things they're particularly interested in.
Hi, Venus Kalesi. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate briefly on the intersection between the G20 summits, which are held each year prior to the actual G20, the G20 summits that are held each year.
Which ones do you mean?
The engagement groups.
Oh, okay.
Held, yeah.
So there are a series of engagement groups, for those of you who aren't aware of this, a large number of engagement groups. The answer to that question is that I think the engagement groups have most influence when they can feed something into an issue that the presidency is pushing particularly. The other thing, of course, is that you've got to give the presidency time to be able to if they're taken with an idea, that they need time to be able to work it up before a summit, because you don't put things on the summit agenda without making sure that you're going to get a reasonable amount of support. Otherwise, that won't work. But I think the engagement groups, they report to the leaders' summit. There are definitely examples where they've brought up ideas that have caught the imagination of the presidency. That happens, but it's certainly also true that ultimately it's the presidency's summit, and they have a lot of sway over what gets talked about and what doesn't.
Let me ask you a big picture question, Dr. Gruen. So as you said, the G20 is like a firefighting department. It's good to have it there and ready to go. And a lot of people worry, of course, about how well the world is prepared for the next potential crisis, right? Yep. So there's an element of this, which is, of course, outside the G20's control, which is that policy space across the world is generally quite low.
Yeah.
But also tensions are high, including economic and political tensions. And then again, you've got the world's largest economy, looking very inwards and driving a lot of these tensions as well. So what's your view or comments on how well you think the G20 would be able to respond to a crisis if it had to step up again?
So I don't know the answer to that, other than it concentrates minds if you've got a crisis. And the best professional advice is that unless you do something in a cooperative way, it'll be very bad for you, not alone, let alone for others. So I agree that the environment is less conducive to cooperation than it was 10 years ago. I agree with that. And I think there are other aspects in which things are less rosy. Levels of government debt are much higher. We don't have as much room with interest rates. There's a bunch of things. But having said that, I still think it's better to be in a world where you have regular communications with people, and the policymakers get together and talk about how things are evolving. That may sound would I prefer a world where we were where we were more prepared? Absolutely, but you work with what you've got.
As you said, it's not the panacea necessarily.
No, it's certainly not.
Dr. Gruen, just two questions. One on process. Could you elaborate a bit on what the role of the Sherpa is? And I'm thinking in the context, does the group of you get together at some stage to settle what the agenda is going to be at the world leaders meeting? In other words, if it doesn't go through the Sherpas, it doesn't happen, so to speak. And if that is a process, secondly, do the Sherpas also have a key role in the settlement of the communique that is put out? In your initial remarks, you said that your objective, or one of your objectives as the Australian Sherpa, was to make this a productive conference for the Morrison government. What sort of priorities do you have in mind going over to Argentina as being things that you would like to see from that point of view?
So the answer, I think, are the sort of several questions in that. I mean, the Sherpas represent their governments. So the Sherpas meet about three times a year. And so you get to know people quite well. Sherpas will put things on the agenda for their governments. Obviously a lot of the work gets done by officials rather than leaders, but Sherpas will put things on the agenda, and I think the right way to think about it is that the host each year has, if not a veto, well, they don't have a veto, but they have that they are first among equals. It's complicated because obviously the big countries not everyone speaks with the same authority around the table. The big countries have more sway, but the way it works is that countries bring things to the table, and Sherpas work with each other to fashion them and see if there's sufficient agreement that they will be worked on in that year. So it's a combination of Sherpas working and the presidency deciding what its areas of focus will be. And the way we operate is taking on board what the presidency wants to do and trying to come up with things that support that area of work. And we have often put forward things that others have supported us on and have got to fruition. So, I mean, some of the things that are going to happen in the G20 final communique are not public yet, but we have been going through that process exactly as we always do, trying to get specific things up that are both things that the Australian government wants, but also are congruent with the current president.
Hi, my name's Leon Berkowitz. I'm at the Reserve Bank. I'm just wondering on your...
here.
I used to be here, that is correct. I'm just wondering on your opinions on some of the weaknesses of the G20. You talked a lot about the strengths. Mm. The weaknesses of the G20 as it operates as an organisation, as an institution.
Well, it has limited power. Not that I want it to be different. I don't want the G20 to become the world government, nor is that going to happen. But obviously, you're dealing in a world, especially in a world where you have profound disagreements. The G20 is a forum for talking about them. But as I said at the end of my remarks, it's not a forum for, ultimately, if countries have profoundly different positions on something where they're interacting, the G20 can help only to the extent that it can help provide a forum for them to talk and for others to talk about how they're going to deal with that situation. So you could certainly say that that's a weakness. It's not a global government that has the power to impose the solutions on sovereign states. I reckon that's the best way to kind of think about the limits.
Steve Greenville from the Lowy Institute. I want to press a bit harder on this, David. I know it's a difficult and sensitive issue, but there is a crisis in the world, or it looks like it.
Yeah.
And the crisis is that globalisation is under threat. Globalisation was the central point which has taken 1 billion people out of poverty and has been reflected in the extraordinary rise in living standards since the Second World War. Now, all we say in response to that when people like the IMF meet is, this trade doesn't look so good. It's going to take 0.5% off GDP. It's 2/5 of nothing. There isn't any sense of something big at stake. I understand the point about this is not a world government, but at the moment we're not even getting frank discussion and looking at options and looking and a clarity in what America is doing out of a discussion. Couldn't you at very least try to get some clarity about these differences of opinion between Trump's America and essentially the rest of the world?
It's a bit of a Dorothy Dixer in one sense. So one of the things that Australia pushed for was to convene a conference on trade, and the IMF came to the party. We provided some of the financial support, and there was a one-day conference on trade on the benefits of trade and what was happening in the globally at the moment, held in the margins of the IMF World Bank meetings in Bali in the middle of October. There was lots of plain speaking there. Christine Lagarde, amongst others, was pretty blunt. The former president of Mexico was particularly blunt in an open session. So but there is no question that many countries, including us, are strategic allies of the United States, and we are measured in what we say in public. Although obviously there are discussions that go on in private.
So, Dr. Gruen, then where does leadership then come from if the world's largest economy is no longer necessarily going to steer things? There's, of course, the presidency of the G20, but you know, a lot of people, particularly in the popular press, will want to talk about, well, whether you know China or whether Germany previously or the EU can step up to the plate, or maybe a clutch of the larger countries. I mean, how do things really work, and what are the prospects for that kind of thing working going forward?
As you may have read in the papers this morning, or I'm not sure exactly when it was reported, I think it was this morning, we're the sixth country to have ratified the TPP-11. And so the TPP-11 will come into force at the end of the year. So there are things going on that obviously in this case don't involve the Americans because they pulled out of it. I think there's nothing more that you can do. Well, you can work on a range of fronts. You can work on trying to keep the WTO functioning, even if we can't get more appointments to the appellate body, which is that it's at that that's the risk that with the appellate body will cease to have three members, which means it can't function sometime next year. So I think my answer is that other countries have to do what they can. They have to spruik the benefits of open trade combined with policies to support people who are hurt by open trade. I mean, I think that the open trade, it has never been the case that free and open trade simply produces winners. That's not true. And the fact that it produced the fact that there can be disruptive domestic economic implications of free trade is something that countries have to take seriously. And if they don't, then they risk support for globalization falling away. And I think that's part of the US story, that without a social safety net that kind of helped people to adjust, trade got the blame.
Maybe one more question on if you can share with everyone. I mean, so are there any of the other major countries stepping up? I think Australia is seen as stepping up, particularly with leadership on TPP. Japan also seems to be becoming much more active, particularly given they're moving into the presidency. Are you seeing that in your work, that there are other countries like Japan and Germany previously really stepping up in the current environment?
So in different ways they are. So there's quite a lot of active discussion about what to do with the WTO. Some of that's led by the Canadians, some of it's led by the EU, some of it's in concert with China and Japan. So it depends on the topic, but there are plenty of countries that that are reaffirming their support for an open trading system because they've benefited so enormously from it.
We might see if there's any final questions.
Why did the US pull out of the TPP?
So I think that the President Trump said that because it was a deal that that he judged didn't help the United States.
Hi, Richard Yetsenga from ANZ. In one of your previous questions, you spoke about institutional structure and looking after some of the losers. Do you think the people who are most vigorously arguing in favour of free trade are doing a good job of also talking about the institutional backing you need to make sure the outcomes actually are fair?
I don't know whether they're doing a good job, but I think it's part of the story, and you have to. And it doesn't help to just say that you have to do it because everybody is benefits from it. But I think there's one of the comments I made in my remarks was that I think we have strong bipartisan agreement. There are fringes, perhaps on both sides, of people in the political spectrum for whom open trade is something that they are against. But I think there's a broad political spectrum which encompasses both of the major parties, the coalition and the Labor is what I mean, that openness is part of Australia's success and that we're not going to walk away from it. But
But having said that, I think there's also a recognition that there are times where we have safety mechanisms which you can argue about, but you know, anti-dumping. There are kind of direct measures, but there's also the general support that's provided for people who are hurt by openness, and I think that is a certainly in all the stuff I've seen from the IMF or the OECD or from others. There's a very strong recognition that openness doesn't work just on its own. It has to be buttressed by other domestic policies.
Otherwise, I might wrap up with one final question from myself. Of course, in the next few weeks, there'll be a lot more attention being put on the G20. Yeah. As we near the next summit. And as you said, it's not a panacea, but everyone kind of wants it to be, or everyone always has very high expectations for what should theoretically be achieved if the G20 is doing its job.
Yeah.
You can't predict what's going to happen at the summit, but you talked about a lot of under-the-radar stuff, the stuff that doesn't get the attention. Maybe for the future discussion that we're probably going to have in the next few weeks, what are some of the things that you would suggest people, you know, look out for coming up at the next summit in terms of these under-the-radar issues? Where do you think there might be some good and meaningful progress where the G20 is really demonstrating its worth in these other more nitty-gritty areas?
So I think the other thing about the sort of under-the-radar stuff is that kind of happens gradually. It's not some big bang. Plenty of these things, whether it's antimicrobial resistance or whether it's reducing remittance costs or the BEPS work on tax, they don't. You can have big announcements, but there's an awful lot of work that has to get done. I don't think there are going to be... I think, understandably, there will be a huge focus on whether the G20 ends up with agreement on climate and trade. And obviously, the agreement would be... it's going to be limited, clearly, because of the strength of the alternative views. I'm kind of going to disappoint you in the sense that I think the below the radar things are going to remain below the radar, and nothing particularly dramatic is going to happen on them at the leaders' summit.
Well, that's a significant prediction in and of itself. Let me please join me in thanking Dr. Gruen for an excellent talk.